This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Prime Minister Theresa May resigns, President Trump and Nancy Pelosi's war of words gets personal, and the Trump administration rolls out a $16 billion plan to help farmers hit by the trade conflict with China. Welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour.
The biggest thing that roiled stocks this week was a further escalation of trade hostilities between the U.S. and China. This week, I believe, indicated a pretty significant shift in the collective thinking by investors, more towards the recognition that this is likely going to be a drawn-out affair and could even get quite ugly. Why is that? Well, most of the focus has clearly moved away from the amount and types of trade between the two countries to much deeper issues over cybersecurity in relation to technology, technological components, and trust over control and possible infiltration of sensitive telecommunication networks. And that is especially true when it comes to the current and future build-out of 5G, something we've been discussing on our show for quite some time. Hence, all of this now focused on the ban for China's Huawei, the largest telecommunications equipment manufacturer in the world and the second largest manufacturer of smartphones. Now, this week, we did see a somewhat constructive development as U.S. granted Huawei a 90-day reprieve from their technology ban. But then a report came out that the White House, according to Bloomberg, is now considering restricting up to 5 more Chinese companies from conducting business with U.S. companies without a government-approved license. So more and more people are beginning to understand, I believe, that this is a longer-term battle between the two major superpowers, and that a trade deal, in whatever form that takes and however long it takes to make one, if such a deal ever happens, will be, as Felix Zuloff and others have said on our show in the past, more of a temporary reprieve in an ongoing, protracted conflict. On the earnings front, we saw a slew of department store chains reporting dismal earnings on Tuesday. Nordstrom's reported their first quarter earnings after market close on Tuesday. It missed analyst expectations following similarly downbeat reports from Kohl's and JCPenney. As a result, Nordstrom's shares tanked more than 11% in after-hours trading. Kohl's as well hitting a new 52-week low and closed down at 1.5%. More than 12%. Also, JCPenney's stock dropping more than 7%. So retail brick and mortar stocks getting hit pretty hard this week. Oil prices took a big tumble, down 7% for the week. This was the worst weekly performance for oil of the entire year, now closing back under $60 a barrel. On the economic news front, expectations are that the big 3.2% GDP number we saw for Q1 is likely now going to be revised lower. The New York Fed's nowcast is at 1.4% for the second quarter. The Atlanta Fed's GDP now is at 1.3%, and then JP Morgan on Friday cut its second quarter growth estimate to a 1% reading. In his latest insight, which we posted on Financial Sense this week, Gary Schilling is doubling down on his recession call for this year. So he wrote that a U.S. recession probably started this quarter. In other news, Elon Musk's SpaceX launched 60 satellites to provide high-speed internet coverage, and MarketWatch notes that this is the first of thousands that Elon Musk plans to put in orbit for global internet coverage. Musk said on Friday that all 60 flat panel satellites were deployed and online a few hundred miles above the Earth. Each satellite apparently weighs about 500 pounds. And the orbiting constellation of satellites, which is called Starlink, is going to continue to grow. Musk says that 12 launches of 60 satellites each will provide high-speed internet coverage throughout the U.S. 24 launches will serve most of the populated world, and 30 launches the entire world. And that will amount to 1,800 satellites in total. Again, all part of an orbiting constellation called Starlink. And he even has more planned launches after that. And last but not least, just coming through on the wires only moments ago, President Donald Trump is sending an additional 1,500 U.S. troops to the Middle East as part of a mostly protective effort to deter Iranian threats.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
They're really at two ends of the spectrum. I mean, when you think about sort of the way macroeconomics is sort of treated, sort of mainstream macro, basically it's a very simple sort of system that tends to equilibrium. All the relationships are essentially linear. There is no financial system of any sort of depth or complexity. The difficulties that arise from assuming interactions between various economic agents is gotten rid of by assuming that there's a what they call a representative agent. So there's just sort of one person, as it were, who's basically acting in an optimal fashion. And you can do the math and calculate the optimal response to particular shocks. That particular individual, the representative agent, is deemed to understand the character of the system, to recognize the objectives of the central bank, to conclude that those objectives will be realized. That, of course, determines his expectations. So you've got this sort of well-functioning system in which the representative agent knows everything and maximizes accordingly. Well, in the sort of the complexity economics area, it's totally different. What you're assuming is you don't have one representative agent. You've got a zillion different people acting either as consumers or as investors, coming together in partnerships, forming institutions. So you get a zillion sort of interacting agents, and they don't actually know much.
Everyone wants to retire well. That's not as easy as it sounds. You need to make the right investment choices, decide when to take Social Security, plan for taxes on your retirement income, and create a legacy for your family. To retire well, you need a roadmap to help you get there. Let Financial Sense Wealth Management help you navigate your way to retirement. We provide comprehensive, thoughtful, and personal retirement planning. Call Financial Sense Wealth Management now at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Start your journey to retiring well today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, markets have been going back and forth, but since hitting an all-time record, they've been going down. What does that mean for investors? Is this a short-term consolidation, the beginning of something bigger, and are further highs possible in the months ahead? Joining us on the program from Oppenheimer is Ari Wald. Ari, as we look at the markets, you guys feel that what we're seeing now is very similar to, let's say, the summer of 2016, after we had a very, very, almost a V-shaped recovery since the beginning of the year. The markets needed a couple months to sort of digest everything. Is this very similar to that, number one? And number two, is this not unusual to see after you've had a steep climb to record highs that the market sort of sits back and maybe consolidates for a while?
Hi, Jim. Yeah, that's exactly the roadmap that we're following, very similar to the summer of 2016, that after a strong rally off the lows, the S&P 500 has paused at resistance, hasn't broken out yet, and it's relieving these overbought excesses by consolidating sideways. It's backing and filling. I think this can continue through what is typically seasonal summertime headwinds. But ultimately, come the back half of the year, we do expect a breakout to new highs. And the reason we think this is the roadmap to follow is that 2018 for us was a small bear market, very similar to the small bear market in 2015. Now that there indeed are still concerns, as mentioned, we're not through resistance, seasonals are poor, and small caps haven't been acting well either. We're keying on a very important positive, which is that global equities have really been in a bear cycle since January of 2018, and now are showing some signs of basing and improving. And I think that improving global breadth ultimately sets up the stage for a stronger back half of the year.
Ari, is this one of those years where that typical Wall Street adage, sell in May, go away, come back after Labor Day, that hasn't held true last year. If you looked at what the markets were doing around May, it was almost straight up until the October highs.
Yeah, seasonal stats are a tough one to actually follow, because if you were to follow it, you have to, every year, you have to sell April 30th and you have to buy back August 31st. No investor's actually going to do that. So for us, it's more secondary confirmation. If we're expecting weakness, that's the time to expect it. I guess what it does instead this time around, we're not expecting significant weakness. So just it mutes our upside in, you know, it, in this, what we think is recovery in the equity market price cycle, probably suggests this is the time where after the strong run up that we've already had year to date, where you could start to soften a little bit and work off some of those overbought levels.
Ari, what strikes me, since the beginning of the year, you saw a rise in just about every asset class. Stocks took off, bonds took off, commodities took off. Likewise, as we saw just heading into December of last year, about every asset class is down. Now, the one thing that really strikes me as unusual last year when the markets were rising into October, it was also alongside rising bond yields. This time around, we have falling bond yields, including the day you and I are doing this interview on Thursday. But up until recently, we've had rising stock prices while bond yields have been falling.
And that's a concern. Regarding the relationship between stocks and interest rates, we are of the view that the direction is equally, if not more important than the level. So generally, low and rising, bullish for stocks, high and falling, bearish for stocks. Now, you can make the case that the level is currently low. In fact, you know, once again, you know, as far as another parallel to 2016, this was the last time interest rates in the Eurozone, Germany specifically, were below zero, where you had negative rates there. But again, if you look back at that 2016 period, it wasn't until rates started to move higher again, which was more in the fourth quarter when the market really started to work again. So I think interest rates need to find a floor. I think that's a missing positive. I think U.S. rates are going to continue to remain anchored by these lower rates overseas. So it's tough to really see that playing out just imminently. But until rates start to move higher again, yeah, speaking in terms of the S&P 500, this consolidation, this backing and filling that, you know, we're discussing today, Jim, is likely to persist.
Let's go to one of the oldest technical theories, and that's Dow theory. You have a breakdown in the Dow industrials. It's correcting, but the transports have broken through their moving averages and breaking down. Does that concern you?
In general, that identifies the primary cycle. You know, when speaking in terms of Dow theory, we're not talking about a trading signal here. So Dow theory has been identified this, the caution really come the fourth quarter of last year. And we like to see transport start to act a little bit better here. And I guess that would be a concern that they are still in this kind of middling basing period that they've been in since the fourth quarter of last year. They haven't quite participated. I think probably an equally, if not more important relationship, rather than just looking at industrials and transports, more important to us is the relationship between big caps and small caps. I think that's really the more important. I think that's the new Dow theory, if you will. And that's also a concern. The Russell 2000 still not being able to push through what we see as an important level at 1600. You know, we kind of often talk about, you know, to confirm these new up cycles, you really want to see participation expand in a very meaningful manner. And we haven't seen that. One metric we love to look at is the percentage stocks on the New York Stock Exchange above their 200-day moving average. Now, that fell to a very depleted reading in December, the type of reading that you would see at a bear market low. Since then, it's improved somewhat, but it hasn't reached the thresholds that would usually mark a new bull market. Think back 1995, 2003, 2009, 2016. So we're still in this in-between where it's been a good start, it's moving in the right direction, but we haven't had the full confirmation. And I think the Russell 2000 needs to get above 1600. Without that, there is still some risk that we're in the still bear cycle as we had been in 2018.
Let's talk about sectors within the S&P that are still doing well. If you look at, for example, consumer staples are, looks like they're breaking out and still in an upward trend. If you take a look at utilities, likewise with utilities, if you look at REITs, they're doing the same. So any comment there?
Yeah, well, you know, those three sectors are typically your countercyclical sectors with relatively high dividends that tend to act as bond proxies. So as interest rates have moved lower, bond prices have risen, and these sectors have outperformed against that backdrop. So until rates, you know, start to move the in the opposite direction, you know, as we said, we'd like to see rates start to move higher, because that's typically the backdrop when pro-cyclical areas of the market start to outperform. And that's typically the type of leadership that you want to see in a sustaining bull market. Again, very similar to 2016, those markets maintained that leadership status through those summer months as rates were still low. It wasn't really until the back half of 2016 when rates started to move the other way, when you saw the rotation into financials sector, the energy sector. Until that happens, there has been a preference for these safe haven assets. In general, I guess we question if outside from a trading basis, looking out more than just the next few weeks to months, if that could really be sustained. But as it stands, those groups are working. We would just be a little bit more selective when picking within those groups, because I think underneath the surface, some of the stocks in those sectors look better than others.
I want to talk about a group of stocks that led the markets last year and led the markets for a couple of years, and that was the FANG stocks. Let's talk about what's going on with them now. Some of the stocks like Apple are breaking down. Let's talk about FANGs. Do you expect them to resume leadership, or are there other sectors, for example, you talk about software, that may be the place to be?
Yeah, I guess it. You know, FANG is such a random collection of stocks. You have some internet names in there. Some, I guess, now Apple's getting included in there now as well. I think in general, if you look at that mix of stocks, they're pausing. I guess some look better than others. I think Amazon looks actually setting up attractive on this pullback as a correction of the support, but thematically, it's not really about these internet names anymore. It's been more about software, where, you know, really across the board, across capitalizations, I can list off 30 software stocks that are moving from the lower left to upper right. That I think that's really the key thematic right now in the tech space. It's the leadership in software. These are higher growth companies that are receiving a premium in this low growth world. And in general, speaking about the relationship between growth and value, it's been correlated to the yield curve. And so as the yield curve has flattened, growth has outperformed. And we think that should continue. I think to make the case for this long-awaited turn into value, investors should be making the case for an accelerating global economy, higher interest rates, and a steeper yield curve. And we don't see that as it stands. You know, as mentioned, you know, U.S. rates are currently anchored by even lower rates overseas. And aside from what could be maybe a little bit of a sentiment swing higher, and you get a backup from the second half of the year, I think in this slow growth world, these high growth software companies are still very attractive investments.
So when you look at this slow growth world that we're in, whether it's, you know, U.S. economic growth or it's global economic growth, growth companies, and that was kind of like one of the big, I guess, drivers of the FANG stocks. These were companies that were growing top line and bottom line. So outside of technology, when it comes to growth, what else is out there?
Well, it's really tough to make a broad-based sector bet outside of technology. In general, a lot of these sector swings have been driven by interest rates and commodity prices. Now, we're making the case that both interest rates and commodity prices are in these kind of longer term ranges, that you could kind of play these swings, that, you know, even this preference for these higher dividend groups, you know, don't be surprised if they become a source of funds if you start to see interest rates move in the opposite direction. So technology for us is a very high conviction sector call. Outside of that, you have to be a little bit more selective, and we're just seeing more pockets of strength here and there. One group where we're seeing some early signs of broadening strength is the industrial sector. Specifically, we're seeing aerospace and defense show relative strength. Railroads have really been strong across the board, and some professional service stocks as well. And really speaking about the industrial sector as a whole, this is typically a mean reverting sector. And by that, I mean that the sector has typically outperformed, looking out 52 weeks, following periods of underperformance in the prior 52 weeks. And that's what we have right as it stands right now. Industrials have underperformed over the last year. And I think as the market progresses through the year, you're going to see investors start to accumulate more cyclical issues, including industrials. From there, again, pockets in restaurants, data centers, and security exchanges as well.
Let's talk about some areas that exhibited some strength but no longer do so, and that is what's going on with commodities, whether you're looking at the pullback we've seen here recently in energy, the pullback in gold. As I mentioned at the beginning of the year, all commodities were taking off, just like what we saw take place in the stock market and bond market. So as you look at the commodity sector, is this range-bound? Is this another corrective phase? And did what we see at the beginning of the year, was that just a bear market rally?
We think a bear market rally. That in general, one of our long-standing recommendations has been to sell these commodity-exposed sectors like energy and materials. Because while the actual commodity has been in a range, and I think should continue to stay in a range, they haven't been rewarded equally on the upside as the downside. They participate with the market when the commodity rises, but then they underperform by a much larger degree when the commodity drops. And that's a very poor risk reward for us. And that's something that we think continues. I think amid fluctuations in the dollar, you have continued fluctuations in these commodity prices. And we see a backdrop very similar to the 1950s and the 1960s and the 1980s and the 1990s, when commodity prices were in a range for years at a time. Interesting, those kind of low, I would say stable inflationary backdrops did coincide with secular strength for the stock market. So I think that could be good for the stock market, less so stocks exposed to those commodity prices.
And finally, I want to talk about the presidential election cycle. We are now in the third year. Typically, the markets do well in, let's say, the third and the fourth year, because like any politician, they want to get reelected. The president is running for reelection. And of course, he knows, you know, a booming economy and a booming stock market bodes well for his reelection chances versus, let's say, a recession and bear market.
That's right. And one phenomenon that I think was a big reason, or what was interesting to note, is that that four-year presidential cycle overlapped with the four-year equity cycle almost consistently up until about 2002, where you would have a bear market from the post-election year into the midterm year, and then you'd have a very strong bull market that started in the midterm year that usually topped out, you know, after the presidential election, shortly after, where there would be policies to help get that to help spruce up the market to a certain degree. We've been off cycle with that. I think longer the change in monetary and quantitative policy over the last decade has been a big part of that. But nonetheless, that's correct. You do tend to see strength in the pre-election year. Typically, that actually starts to wane a little bit come the back half of the year. In fact, we're just finishing the best 9 months of the presidential cycle, which is fourth quarter of the midterm, into the second quarter of the pre-election. But nonetheless, it's food for thought, something to consider. You know, again, we think the Fed cycle much more important than the presidential cycle.
And, you know, come to thinking of the Fed cycle, the Federal Reserve is reluctant to be raising interest rates in the year of a presidential election. You saw that with Janet Yellen in 2016. She talked about raising interest rates several times, but she waited till December after the election was over. Likewise, nothing was done in the election of 2008. So the Fed seems to be, unless we're in the midst of a crisis, they tend to kind of pull back and not do anything until after the election is over. Is that something, if they're possibly either going to cut or raise rates, we could see happen next year?
We don't have a view on the forward path of the Fed, but I could tell you this. The fact that they've paused their policy, it has caused the yield curve to continue to flatten and even invert depending on the duration that you're looking at. You have had an inversion looking at the 10-year minus the 3-month. You haven't had it looking at the 10-year minus the 2-year. Historically, that is an ominous signal for the overall equity market, where you do see forward returns turn below average following a yield curve inversion. If you were to really look at it based as a timing signal, it's less efficient. If you were to actually act on the moment it inverts, forward returns don't change much more meaningfully. But as an actual signal to act on, you know, we joke around about that the time to get concerned is when the Fed starts cutting interest rates. What do they see that we may or may not see? You think back when they started cutting in the fall of 2007. Again, directionally, lower rates do give us concern. If they were to start cutting interest rates here, we'd have to give a very strong look to our overall equity outlook.
So, Ari, given the fact that you think probably the markets are very similar to 2016 after reaching a strong high at the beginning of the year, it was sort of back and filling until we got into the fall of 2016. Given that you see this over the next couple months, as an investor, what would you be doing?
I'd be selective in my portfolio. I think equity exposure is warranted on the possibility that we have had the necessary reset in a lot of our indicators. I think one thing that's been off here is that we've had these price resets, but not the economic reset, that we're still in the same economic cycle that we've been in for the last 10 years. So you still have to be conscious of these late cycle economic conditions, but understanding it's been a very difficult, you know, 12 plus months for a lot of these equity markets, depending on how you measure them. So I think a lot of the worst is behind us when you consider most equity benchmarks peaked in January of 2018. So I want to be exposed to technology and pockets of industrials and just be a little bit more selective in my exposure.
Good advice. As we close, if our listeners would like to follow the great work you guys do, how could they do so?
They could follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Ari Wald.
All right, Ari, as always, thanks for coming on the program. All the best to you, sir.
Thank you. Take care.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
You cannot build respect with somebody else's currency. So for the last 15 years or so, the Chinese have been preparing for a monetary war against the dollar. And the dollar is quite vulnerable today because the Americans have decided to weaponize the dollar. So if you use dollars now between France and China, for example, the American legal system applies to the transaction, which was not the case 10 or 15 years ago. So this is a big loss of sovereignty, both for France and for China, and it's not acceptable. You have to continue to do it in dollars because everybody is organized to do it, but you want to do something else. So basically what the Chinese are trying to do, they are trying to create an alternative currency to the dollar.
I'm Chris Prytower, and welcome to The Big Picture. You know, in the financial markets, as so often happens, when a crisis erupts, it really can happen suddenly. It catches investors by surprise. They seem to just come out of the blue and catch everyone off balance. And it really doesn't matter if it was the Great Depression of the 30s, the oil embargo, the great bear market of 1974, even the bursting of the tech bubble, the mortgage bubble. and the recession of 2007, 2009. You might even be thinking more recently in the sudden market crash that was last fall in 2011 or 2016. Either way, the seeds of the crisis are there, but they go on ignored by the media, by politicians, and even investors, until they erupt and become front-page headlines and 24-hour around-the-clock coverage by a blindsided public media. Now, if you've been listening to this program over the last 2 years, we've highlighted four main risks to the markets. And what we're going to do on this show is revisit one of those risks, since it has worsened. It's now even gotten the attention of the Fed with Chairman Powell this week. Now, let's listen to a question that was posed to the chairman this week.
Are you worried that by taking a pause in raising interest rates, we've had low interest rates for so long, are you contributing to a bubble in corporate debt?
So we've called out corporate debt as a risk, more of a macroeconomic risk, I think, than a financial stability risk. The sense of that being that if you have companies that are highly levered and we do go into a downturn, they're going to be less able to weather that and keep serving their customers and, may have to do layoffs and things like that, which so they can amplify, in effect, a negative downturn. So we watch that. We also watch carefully for the exposure of the financial system to these companies. In other words, banks are arranging a lot of these loans. The question is, what is their exposure? Do they retain big pieces of the loans? Do they have obligations to underwrite loans, which build up in a pipeline? So we monitor those risks very carefully. And frankly, the banks monitor them much better with our support and help than they did before the crisis. So it's a concern. It's something that we're watching. Of course, November and December and January were much slower months for those sorts of things. But it'll be something that we're always paying close attention to.
Now, the four risks we've identified to the economy and the markets over the last 2 years are, first, the bubble in index funds. Number two, concentration of risks in the financial industry. Number three, the shrinkage of liquidity. And I think it's safe to say that nobody likes shrinkage. But lastly, the corporate debt markets. Today, we return to the corporate debt market as it's grown in size. It now represents a clear and present danger to the financial markets, as highlighted by Chairman Powell this week.
You know, Chris, what brought this issue to the forefront this week is the Fed released their annual financial stability report. Now, the Fed monitors and analyzes four risks to the financial system. Number one, valuation risk. The stock market's getting at crazy valuations like they did during the tech bubble. Number two, the borrowing of businesses and individuals. Number three, the leverage within the financial sector, think the banking system. And number four, funding risk. What are the risks that companies can roll over their debt and there's liquidity? So in terms of those four risks and vulnerabilities, they are elevated in all four areas. The financial markets is, according to the Fed, exhibit a high appetite for risk if you take a look at where money's going. Borrowing by business and individuals are also elevated with a rapid increase in debt concentrated among the riskiest firms amid signs of deteriorating credit standards, which will be the subject of today's big picture. Now, leverage in the financial sector, there's the good news there, remains strong with our largest banks. So within the financial sector, it looks healthy, while funding risk, at least at this time, remain rather low.
Well, let's move on to the problem area where the risk remains the highest. And it looks like that's non-financial corporate debt. And that has now the concern and the attention of the Fed.
Well, let's begin with what the Fed discusses in their financial stability report. Number one, debt in the consumer sector remains in line with economic activity. In other words, it's not out of line like it was leading up to the financial crisis in 2007 when we just saw crazy mortgages taken out, no-doc loans, ninja loans. None of that exists today. So unlike 2007, the Fed does not see consumer debt as an issue, at least at this time. The area they identify as high risk is the debt owned by business is historically high. And in particular, risky debt issuance has picked up recently as interest rates have fallen. I mean, everybody right now in this low interest rate environment that we've been involved for the last decade, Everybody's searching for yield. I don't care if it's a pension fund, investors, institutional investors, but that's what pushes people on the risk spectrum. Now, the Fed also highlights that credit standards for business loans have deteriorated and gotten even worse. Now, our own research at our firm shows that the corporate debt market has risen from roughly about 48% of GDP in 2010 to 57% of GDP as of the end of 2018. Now, the risk here is in non-financial corporations have a smaller base of income and assets to draw on compared to, let's say, households where the majority of debt is in a mortgage which is tied to their home. Now, there are two graphs in the Fed's financial stability report, and we're going to put a link to that report. It's about 60 pages. We're going to put a link to that on our website. But it shows that debt has risen to 40% of the balance sheet of risky firms. And here's the more important one. Interest rate coverage has fallen below 20%. Now, in the past, interest rate coverage was twice that amount. The danger here is in an economic downturn, companies have less of a cushion to make those interest and principal payments should the economy turn down, which we know it eventually will. Now, in addition to the rising debt levels at the risky end of the corporate sector, they also see declining interest expense coverage. In other words, companies do not have enough profits and cash flow coverage to make their interest payments on the debt. They also see deteriorating loan covenant protections, and that's very important for you as an investor, because if something goes wrong at the company, what are your protections? We have highlighted this lack of liquidity in past programs, which is another issue, which is liquidity, because there's a proliferation of bond funds and bond ETFs who are the major owners of this low-quality debt. Now, this was highlighted in the Fed stability report. According to the Fed, U.S. corporate bond fund ownership of this high-risk debt has more than tripled over the past decade. It now amounts to about $1.4 trillion, and according to the Fed, mutual bond funds are estimated to own about one-sixth of the outstanding corporate bonds and one-fifth, or 20%, of the leveraged loans. Now, junk bonds have also doubled in size over the last decade. But here's the real issue. Today, the triple B bond market now represents 50% of the investment-grade market. Now, when you add triple B to junk bonds, low-quality debt makes up nearly three-quarters of the corporate debt market, and that's where, as we have pointed out over the last 2 years, we think that's where the epicenter of the crisis is going to lie. Now, the Fed goes on to cite the real risk of this low-quality debt held by bond funds and bond ETFs in a crisis or the next downturn. They went on to report, for example, the difficulties in Q4 of last year when in December, many of these funds experienced large outflows as investors panicked, and the funds and ETFs experienced large outflows by scared investors. During this period, what happens is when everybody rushes to the market and there's no buyers out there, what happens is there's a big spread between bid and ask. In other words, what buyers are willing to pay for a bond and what sellers really want. And that widened during the month of December. It was difficult for a lot of these funds to unload their assets. And when they did so at distressed prices. So the good news is, since Q4 of last year, many of these funds have seen prices come back. But I want to point out, we aren't in a recession, and we didn't have a financial crisis. What we had was a panic sell-off.
So it's kind of like a seesaw in a way. The Fed highlighted that the debt conditions in the corporate sector have risen, as well as deteriorated over the last decade. So even though we saw a steep sell-off in Q4 of last year, prices did rebound this year. So for the moment, would you say, Jim, that things appear to be okay underneath the surface? I mean, what do you think can go wrong here?
You know, the real problem, in the fourth quarter, the economy was still growing, and we really didn't have a financial crisis. It was kind of brought on by algo trading, comments made by the Fed, comments made by the president on the extension of waivers on oil. The problem begins when the economy slows down. What happens? Interest rates begin to rise because of risk. The debt markets have been supported by record low interest rates and a strong economy. We still have that. The problems rise when economic growth slows down, it weakens, or in a worst case, it heads into a recession. What happens? credit spreads would widen as they did last fall, sales and profits would decline along with the economy, interest coverage would decline, and defaults would begin to rise. Now, there's also the additional danger of lack of liquidity and distressed pricing brought about by, let's say, large selling by panic investors, as we saw last December. Remember, much of this debt is now held by mutual bond funds and ETFs. When they all experience redemption, in other words, when investors want to get out, it's kind of like yelling fire in a movie theater. When they all want to sell at the same time, the question arises, who are they going to sell to? Themselves? I don't think so. One reason we hold large liquid sovereign debt is we hope to be one of the buyers if this debt is sold at distressed prices. It's the same thing that happened in 2016. If you recall, in the first 6 weeks of the year, stock market went down every year, bond spreads blew out. Remember, the Fed raised interest rates for the first time in December 2015. We had the China crisis. All of that happened in a period of 6 weeks. And during that period of time, funds were forced to sell distressed debt. I remember buying a oil service company. They had a one-year bond. It had a 5% coupon, and we bought it for 95 cents. So we had a 5% capital gain and 5% interest. So that is going to become an issue. And the other one, and we've highlighted this, and I think this is the big one, which is the amount of triple B debt now makes up about 50% of the corporate bond market. Now, triple B, if you're not familiar with it, is one step above junk bond status. So if you look real close to a lot of those investment grade bond funds or ETFs, you will find they are sitting on high levels of triple B debt. And those triple B bonds could become the first domino to fall whenever the next recession hits, triggers a cascade of selling in the debt markets, kind of like what happened when Lehman went bankrupt in the fall of 2008 and set in motion an avalanche of selling and triggered a full-blown crisis as one financial institution after another went belly up because they were all tied together with credit default swaps and a lot of this, what I call junk mortgages. And what it took the Fed, the government, taxpayers, and large investment banks to bail them out. Think of what happened in just a period of about 6 weeks in the fall of 2008. Merrill Lynch had to be rescued. AIG had to be rescued by the government. Wachovia had to be rescued by another large investment bank.
Where, or maybe I should say, what sectors would you say this high risk is located?
You know, probably, and we've talked about this in our energy segment, at the top of the list is energy, especially in the shale patch. A couple other sectors, and we'll talk about that in just a second, consumer services, healthcare equipment, retailing, electrical equipment, just to mention just a few.
How would you say, Jim, this would play out, though, if the eventual recession that we hear so much talk about, once that arrives, how would you say it plays out?
You know, it starts out usually with one domino or event triggering, and then that sets off a cascade or waterfall decline. It sets in motion. Step number one, interest rates begin to rise. Credit spreads begin to widen as the economy weakens. Step two is interest rates rise and credit spreads rise as well. Recession risk further widens spreads because as interest rates rise, the economy weakens. What do people think when the economy starts to weaken? Oh my goodness, another recession. Investors began demanding higher interest rates, so you have credit spreads widen. Step three, triple B debt is downgraded, which triggers widespread selling. Step four, mutual funds and mutual ETFs begin to liquidate as they are forced to sell with widespread redemptions. Step number five, if everybody owns the same stuff and they're all selling it at the same time, what happens is what you saw in December. Liquidity dries up. So liquidation takes place at a distressed price as bid and ask spreads widen. Step number six, as credit defaults increase, credit spreads widen, and now it begins to spill over into the healthy sectors of the economy. Step number seven, the stock markets react, they sell off, and a bear market begins. And finally, step number eight, financial deterioration leads to consumer spending. Consumers pull back, businesses pull back, and the next thing we know, we're in the middle of a recession.
Well, you pointed out that the bond funds and the bond ETFs, that they're the ones that own a whole lot of this crap. What sectors is this debt concentrated in?
You know, the big sectors are materials, consumer staples, discretionary, communication services, healthcare, and at the top of the list would be energy. So as a group, the energy sector accounts for probably the greatest share of the universe at this time. Much of this is many of those small shale companies that are heavily leveraged and are at risk of default. There's also what we call the leveraged loan market, which are heavily laden with debt, along with what we call covenant-lite restrictions that would protect investors in case of a default. Now, the big banks own very little of this stuff. There are two banks that are heavily exposed to this debt. And so I guess the good news is none of the big guys own this stuff, but there are two regional banks that are the large owners of this stuff and could be in deep financial trouble should this thing unfold.
What other risks are there, Jim, that you see here besides triple B debt, leveraged loans, and junk bonds?
You know, I think what makes this cycle so unique is low interest rates gave rise to, number one, the triple B market. Because if you own an investment grade fund compared to a junk bond fund, investors buy funds on yield. So in order to get that high yield with low interest rates, people went to lower quality investment grade bonds, the bottom of the list, which was triple B. But also what we saw in this economic recovery is non-cyclical areas of the economy, usually areas you would not consider to be leveraged, they leveraged up because of the low interest rates. Everything from pharmaceuticals, healthcare, equipment companies, staples, and of course, retailing.
So I go back to how I began this segment. These shocks, they seemingly are just out of the blue, but they are catching markets and investors by surprise. And just like the Fed did this week, Jim, you've highlighted the future vulnerabilities.
Yeah, the high levels of corporate debt doesn't necessarily have to trigger a recession to pose a risk to the economy, but it could be the domino that sets things in motion, as I've highlighted in just the sequence risk we just talked about. When one domino falls, think of Lehman, what that triggered in 2008. So it only takes one domino to start things off.
Let's bring this back to investors then. What does it mean for them? What should investors be doing?
You know, given where we are right now, I would be owning high-quality, short-term sovereign debt. That is what we're doing, as we hope to be able to be a buyer of this debt at incredibly distressed prices when the crisis unfolds. That is what we did in 2016 and in 1994. Now, if I owned an investment-grade bond fund, I would do my homework and I would find out how much of the fund or ETF bond holdings are triple B. Because it says investment grade, and you know, the typical investor is thinking, I own AAA stuff. That may not be the case. You may find that the majority of what you own is triple B. If it is high, I would gradually begin to get out of it before the next downturn hits and switch to high-quality short-term sovereign debt. I would be doing a lot of risk assessment now of what it is you own. You don't want to wake up like investor did, let's say, in 2008, or let's say in Q4 of last year. We're coming to the end of a business cycle, and at this point, you want to focus on quality and liquidity.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.